Okay, Steve's here. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the December 18th meeting of the Portland City Council. Carla, would you please call the roll?
Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Hales?
Here. Good morning. Let's start with communications items, please. Number 1184.
Request of Lisa Herlinger to address council regarding her small business, Ruby Jewel Ice Cream.
Lisa, good morning. Good morning and welcome, please. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, you're welcome. Hi.
Just give us your name, and you've got 3 minutes.
My name is Lisa Herlinger, and I started a Ruby Jewel Ice Cream in 2005. I started selling ice cream sandwiches at the Portland Farmers Market. Soon realized that there was a demand for ice cream sandwiches and a need in the grocery stores for an all-natural ice cream product. So I obsessively looked around, and I really didn't see anything that was quite like it, that was all-natural using local ingredients. So I worked I entered a contest at the Food Innovation Center, which is down in Northwest Portland, and it was called the America's Food Fight, and they said, if your product has commercialization potential, come and, you know, enter this contest. So I ended up winning, which allowed me a whole year of time to work on the product and take it from making, you know, 100 cookies to, you know, thousands of cookies, and really helped me to market the product and get it out there. So I luckily got that jump start to the business, and that was in 2005. We grew the business very organically through credit card debt and a few small business loans to have distribution all along the West Coast. We are in mostly like Whole Foods and higher-end natural food stores. And in 2010, we opened our first retail scoop shop in North Mississippi. So that was a huge success right away, which enabled us to open our second scoop shop down here on Southwest 12th Avenue. So we've got a couple businesses going. We have a distribution side of the business, and we have two retail scoop shops, all under the Ruby Jewel name. And are at that stage right now of really, we maxed out our production capacity in our own kitchen that we have in North Portland where we make all the ice cream. So we're now working on, you know, what the next steps are to grow the business, because we're really, truly going to be the ice cream brand that's from Portland that goes, you know, nationwide. So I'm really now at that stage of working to, you know, raise some more money, get some more help from people, because it's been really me and my sister that have been growing the business for the past 8 years.
That's great.
A couple quick questions?
Yes, yes.
First of all, how many people do you employ in your company?
Yeah, so it's seasonal. So in the height of the season, which is the summertime here in Portland, just about 50.
Wow.
Yeah, just
about
50.
And you said that you're all natural, locally sourced. So
yeah.
Do you get your dairy products from?
From Junction City, Oregon, and from Lockmead. Lockmead Dairy, we've been working with them for about 7 years now.
And what's your most popular product?
At our scoop shops is a caramel ice cream with salted chocolate on top. So
that's the diet one. Right?
Yes,
that's the diet. Yeah, all low calorie.
That's the low calorie one.
Yeah. People here verifying that.
Yeah, we won't go sugar free, or, you know, I really truly believe if you're gonna, you know, make ice cream, you know, we make a high butter fat, you know, really good ice cream. So, yeah, and then ice cream sandwich wise is probably our fresh mint with a dark chocolate cookie is our top seller. Yeah.
See, now everybody's hungry.
I have to say that, based on personal experience, I can attest that that fresh mint with dark chocolate cookie is dangerously addictive. And if I am, according to my doctor, that product alone has increased my risk of heart attack by 8.5%. And I think that your whole business should be regulated as a producer of controlled substances.
Yeah, no, you know, all in moderation. But if you're going to eat that way, you might as well eat something that, you know, that's...
I think Ruby Jewel is a great name. How did it get?
Oh, the name is it's named after a yurt in Colorado. I used to live in Steamboat Springs, and I went on a ski trip, and it's the name of a yurt, Ruby Jewel, right by Jewel Lake, and literally had no connection with ice cream at the time. I just loved the name, and now it's a big part of that.
95% of our small businesses employ 50 or fewer employees.
Yeah,
she's right at that sweet spot.
Yeah, right.
The sort of the heart of our local economy, and it's great to have these success stories.
Yeah, another question I have, and that is from your experience, it sounds like one thing that worked was the business incubator function that the Food Innovation Center mm-hmm. played. One thing that maybe didn't work initially was access to credit, since you were using credit cards and other by hook and by crook stuff. So is that a fair characterization, that access to credit was maybe a tougher hurdle?
It was hard. I had a loan through the Oregon Economic Development Commission, OECD, and I had a loan through the Portland Business Development Fund.
Mm-hmm.
I had some help through the Food Innovation Center, a little bit of pull from people there that helped me a little bit more. I also got a loan from Whole Foods, and we're working on our second loan to launch our pint line. Whole Foods has been a great resource for small businesses in the food world, at least. It's tough to get, you know, significant numbers, but I think it's possible. Mm. It's just doing some research.
So I hope you're working with PDC now in your expansion plans.
Well, I haven't been working with them yet, but
well, we'll make sure to send them your way.
Okay, sounds good.
I have one more question, and that is, do you provide sick time to your employees?
We now we're gonna, you know, in the we do, we have some alternative benefits that we try to offer, but I'm glad we're doing this, but I also, you know, there's this risk of having it taken advantage of by the employees. You know, that definitely can happen.
As you know, we're going to be implementing it January 1st, so I just wanted to offer to you and other business owners if you need assistance understanding things or...
Yeah, no, I think we were pretty good. Yeah, we're on that.
Very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks
Thank
so
you.
Much. Appreciate you coming in. Thank you. Thanks. All right, next one, please.
Item 1185, mm-hmm. request of Pia Welch to address council regarding West Halen Island. She informed us she's not able to make it.
Oh, okay. So I think she sent us some material, but maybe someone else did. Sorry. 1186, then.
Request of Tom Deshane to address council regarding West Halen Island.
Good morning, Tom.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the opportunity to speak before you. I know a couple of you. You should have...
Yes,
an aerial photo in front. My objective here today is to speak to you on behalf of, in support of the Port of Portland's plan to develop approximately 300 of the 800-acre West Halen Island. I'll also give you a sort of written testimony, but basically I wanted to cover about 3 points. Number one, emphasize the shortage of industrial land. Number two, to identify some of the different uses regarding industrial warehousing, et cetera, and number three, try to fit that into a balance. By way of introduction, I'm an industrial real estate broker with North Spakes and Simpson. I've been doing this for about 30, 35 years, and a member of the Portland Freight Committee, and most recently a member of the Industrial Lands Watershed Health PEG group. So I feel like I've been involved in that and then trying to make a living leasing and selling industrial properties as well. Regarding the industrial lands we're on, as you probably well know, it's been now confirmed that there's a shortage, relatively speaking, of industrial land, not only in the city of Portland, but throughout the metropolitan area. And I think that this is one situation where that could greatly benefit that need as well as shortage. We could talk about brownfields, a lot of other things, but that's the one point I'd like to make, kind of confirm. The second point is the uses of industrial land. And as you probably well know throughout the meetings that I've been involved in and as a practitioner, having industrial lands available is one thing, and making them economically work is another. But the use is so critical. A warehousing distribution center are low job intents per acre. Manufacturing, the Intels, the Gundersons, et cetera, are very high intense as far as number of jobs per acre. But to make the industrial system work, we need that combination of rail served, of marine served, of road service to accommodate not only warehousing and or manufacturing, but those bulk distribution type entities that make our whole economy work. So I wanted to make that point, that the uses are of very significant in how those are utilized. Third thing that I did want to talk about is the balance of available land and those uses. And when it comes to like a West Hayden Island, I think that it's very important that we as a community are aware of what that asset means. I know there's been a lot of talk about environmental issues. There's 500 acres of open green space, which I think is a pretty good balance. But one of the things I wanted to for sure make you aware of is as you look at this aerial photo of the approximate 300 acres, there's only about less than half of that that is would be affected by open green space. Now, I'm not a geologist. I'm not a but common sense tells me that I think it isn't like we're taking 300 acres of pristine open space and converting it to heavy industrial. My point is that we're only taking about half of that.
Tom, you used your time, so wrap up, and I've got another question for you. So
yep. That's overall the first, sorry about that.
That's fine. So question I have is you're in this business of trying to accommodate industrial users on different kinds of land. Where's the shortage right now? What kind of space? I mean, we have, for example, about 600 acres of brownfield property right along the Willamette River that, but for the cleanup, would be available. That's another challenge that we face as a city. What's the kind of space that you're seeing great demand for that we have a hard time meeting?
I would, roughly speaking, not only just Portland, but the metropolitan area, basically 3 to 10 to 12 to 15 acres, ideal, or overall, probably around 3 to 12 to 15 acres. That shortage, we've got a few big parcels, and you've seen probably the NAOP report, et cetera. I'll tell you, when you're working with somebody that says, hey, I need to build a building, 40, 50, 60,000 square feet, that takes about 3 to 5 acres. And to find a property that's available, number one, that's realistically priced, that can be developed, that, I think, is the heart of our users in the Portland marketplace, and that's where I think the big shortage is.
So those smaller parcels, not necessarily rail-served, right?
I mean, not necessarily. I mean, those are on occasion, but I mean, that's the real heart of what I think we're missing.
Don't we have some available dirt in Airport Way, for example, that meets those specifications?
Some, not much. I can count on one hand the available parcels that are in that size range that are zoned light industrial. No kidding, you would think. You drive along there, you go, wait a minute, I see this green patch right here. It looks like it's 10, 15 acres. But when you drill down to available properties that are on the market that aren't being held by a user to develop later on or are in the development stages, not many. And relatively speaking, I would say at best, there's probably about 3 or 4 sites that are 5 acres and up, and I can only think of about 1 or 2 that are 5 acres or less. And that's just Airport Way. You get to the brownfield areas, it's even less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. But I really appreciate having the opportunity to
discuss this.
Yeah,
thank you. No, this is helpful. Appreciate it. Thanks very much. Thanks for coming in. Okay, appreciate it, Tom. Then next one's 1187.
Request of Mike Roach of Paloma Clothing to address council regarding challenges of dealing with competition from the Internet.
Good morning, Mr. Roach.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to be here, and I want to just start out with a thank you to the council for your support, your proclamation and dedication and support of Small Business Saturday back right after Thanksgiving. Those kinds of and your support for the Little Boxes program and our Golden Ticket program in Multnomah and Hillsdale, that kind of support goes a long way and is really heard by small business owners out there who can sometimes feel pretty lonely and like they're not being listened to. That makes a big, big difference. Of course, we hope that the visibility that we had over that weekend, we hope it continues and lasts for the entire holiday season. That'll remain to be seen, but it's a great time to highlight small businesses, and we really appreciate the fact that you did that. Our Golden Ticket program that we've done for the last 4 years with Multnomah and Hillsdale business districts working together is, you know, growing and getting stronger, and we're pleased to see that Beaumont District Association picked it up for the first time this year. Some quick facts about Paloma Clothing. We've been in business since 1975. That's 38 and a half years. I wasn't in diapers when I started the business, but I was 25 and I turned 63 about 2 weeks ago. I started with my mom, Phyllis Roach, in 1975, have managed it and owned it with my wife, Kim Osgood, since 1986. It's 1,500 square feet in Hillsdale Business District. I'm pleased to count all of you as, or they're your family members, as customers at our store. I really appreciate that as well. We have 15 employees. We're really proud to be able to offer the following benefits to them. We pay 85% of their health insurance. We set aside 10% of their wages into a retirement plan. We provide them with vacation pay and earned sick pay. I point out we can only do those things because we have great customers. We can't do it just out of the goodness of our heart. You have to have customers and sales and profits that support the ability to provide those benefits. I'll get to my point real quick here. Brick-and-mortar stores do a lot more than sell stuff. We give, for a lot of teenagers, it's the place they get their very first job. And indeed, my wife, Kim, has called Paloma Clothing a finishing school for young adults, because we've taken some young people we saw potential in, but we're kind of rough around the edges, and they've been with us a long time, and they really learn how to conduct themselves in a really adult way, and they learn sales skills. They're around positive adult role models. It makes a big difference in how they are able to develop as individuals. We donate to school auctions. We're a $500 sponsor for the Riki Elementary School Auction. We're proud to say that. I wanted to point out that we also donate to multiple school auctions, including alcohol-free graduation parties. So local businesses do a lot. We also donate, locally owned businesses donate at twice the rate to local nonprofits as big box and internet companies do. Because literally you can walk in our door and ask for a donation and probably talk to the decision maker that same day. The door is always open.
I need you to wrap up soon,
okay.
But I like what you're
covering
here.
All right, so I'm going to get to my point here. The primary point is, we really appreciate the fact that you highlight the importance of locally owned businesses versus big box businesses, but we are facing really incredible competition from the internet now, and to the degree that you can remind the public, Portlanders out there, that 67 cents of their dollar stays in the local economy when they spend at a locally owned business, but zero stays behind when they buy over the internet. That's an important piece of education that I don't think Portlanders fully realize. And if you can help us lead the charge on that education piece, we would very much appreciate it. Otherwise, we're going to have nothing but payday loan shops and coffee shops in our business districts with no stores there actually selling products. So, again, thank you for all your support of small businesses. It's a big deal.
Thank you, Mike. And one thing I'd like to point out is that even purchases that sort of instinctively we think you make through international internet companies, you can sometimes make through local businesses. For instance, I mean, in our neighborhood, if you're ordering books that you can't find on the bookshelves anywhere, you could go to Amazon or you could walk down to Annie Bloom's in Multnomah Village and ask them to order the book for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mike, just two things. Yeah. My wife, Patricia, when she was pregnant with our son, Chapin, bought all of her clothing at Paloma because she liked the looser-fitting clothing during her pregnancy. So she's a big fan. And the second thing is, how did you do? How were your sales on Small Business Saturday?
We were up on Small Business Saturday. We were up 30%. Wow. On that day. And on the Sunday that followed, I think just from the inertia of the Small Business Saturday, we're actually up 40%. So those were some big increases we saw.
That's great.
Those haven't continued like that since then, but it sets a good tone for the holiday season, and we're cautiously optimistic that we're going to have all small businesses are going to have a really good season. But you guys, seriously, the council made a real difference in what Portlanders did over those 3 days because of the visibility that you, through working with Heather Hale at Venture Portland and the media, brought to the issue of shopping local. So keep up the good work.
Well, we appreciate it. Same to you. I mean, it's interesting how if we're all reinforcing that message, it apparently is getting through.
Right. Good. That's the encouraging. It's very encouraging that there's a certain chunk of the public that's actually paying attention.
Yeah.
That's always encouraging.
And it's pretty congruent with Portlander's values about localism. And we heard that earlier today about food. I met earlier this week with a technology business that's planning to move to Portland and bring a bunch of new jobs, which is great. But they said that our tendency towards localism and how we shop is one of the factors that caused them to think it would be a good fit for their company.
Wow.
So it seems like it's not only the people that are already here, but some of the folks that are considering coming here are attracted by that set of values that you're expressing through the way you operate your business and the Little Boxes campaign and all the rest of this.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that, Mayor. That's a good sign. If we can use that as one of the things that attracts larger businesses that, of course, employ more people individually than our small businesses, that's great, because then you get the virtuous circle going where all those, you know, where locally owned businesses, of course, we buy all our business support services from other locally owned businesses. That's how you hit the 67 cents. We use a local accountant, local printer, local media. They, in turn, use other locally owned businesses, and that's how you keep, once that money stays, goes across the counter and stay and into a locally owned business, it just keeps circulating in the locally owned sector because of the way our businesses behave versus a large business buys all those support services from corporate headquarters. Mm-hmm. It's not evil. It's just a different business model that has a different impact. Mm-hmm. So,
great. Thank
so
you
again,
very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Take care. Great. All right. And we have one more communication item, 1188.
Request of Marianne Schwab to address council regarding People's Water Trust petition initiatives.
Good morning, Marianne.
It's hard to talk fast. But hang on. Here we go. For the record, my name is Marianne Schwab. I'm a community advocate living in the inner southeast neighborhood, Sunnyside, 44 years and counting. And I'd like to start out with discussing things going on with the League of Women Voters. Then I'll go on to my own private comments. As a member of the League of Women Voters, I would like to quote from their Think Before You, Inc. brochure written by the League of Oregon. This brochure reminds us to think before we sign anything, especially before we sign off on initiative when we have not had the opportunity to read it. Your signature is valuable. Here are the reasons why citizens should be informed. Consider all six questions in this brochure. Number one, is it complex? Some decisions can be simple yes or no votes. Complex issues may need a thorough legislative examination. Number two, is it confusing? Some initiatives aren't well written. They may have conflicts requiring court interpretation or resolution. Number three, does it belong in our Constitution? Initiatives can be local, statutory, or constitutional. Should this become fundamental, constitutional law, protected from change? Further correction by constitutional amendment can be cumbersome and costly, requiring another vote of the people. Number four, how will it be funded? Is it an unfunded mandate? Would it force our legislature to pull funds from other essential programs? Consider how this would limit government budget flexibility. Initiatives should create their own revenue sources, not earmark, restrict, or obligate specific percentage from the general fund. Number five, who is behind it? Chief petitioners must file campaign finance transactions under the Initiatives Petition Committee, which must be opened by the Elections Division before the filing officer approves a petition circulation. You can find out who the other real supporters and opponents are after the petitions are certified as a ballot measures and assigned numbers. Chief petitioners do not need to be citizens or even Oregon residents. That is huge. Get contribution and expense reports from the Oregon Elections Division, and we have the information on the brochure how to do that. Number six, before signing, ask for ID. A paid, not volunteer signature gatherers are now required to carry badges, ID, and photos issued by the Secretary of State. They aren't required to wear or show the ID unless you ask as a Secretary of State, a BOLI, a Bureau of Labor and Industries, or the Attorney General. But refusal should lead you to refuse to sign. If a case of fraud arises, you have information that could help authorities. Again, think before you ink. Understand your signature is valuable, more valuable than your vote. Considering the fewer signatures are required to approve petitions before ballot measures, only sign initiative petition you believe should become law. Again, think before you ink. And I'm hearing the bell, so I'd like to add one more little thing, please. Understand the rest of my comments are mine and mine alone, no way representing the League of Women Voters. I am asking each of you, as well as the viewers watching City Council this morning, to take time to read two points of view on the PUD for Portland, published in the Southeast Examiner, December 2013. Time for a Public Water District by Floyd Jones and Kent Crawford, and Why We Oppose the Portland Water District by Bob Salinger. Personally, I feel Portland's Water Bureau may be at risk when unknowingly citizens sign off on the Public Water District initiative based on two or three misleading sentences. Big print giveth, small print taketh away. Prior to signing, my guess few, if any, people, with exception of the League of Women Voters, have actually read the 26 pages detailing how the proposed ballot measure will change parts of the city charter. Or have people taken time to Google those enforcing it? Albeit, if approved, misinformed voters won't be surprised when the region's largest industrial water users and polluters would actually pay less than residential households and small businesses. Again, think before you ink. Now, there's a couple things here. League of Women Voters also have ongoing education groups, and I want you to go back, and this is to our Commissioner Steve Novick, who I've heard again and again talk about the we're in the earthquake zone time period. And he keeps talking about emergency preparedness. While, yes, I support having the fire trucks and emergency equipment on the west side, more important, after listening to the communication format, freedoms, limitations, responsibility, even by some of your city employees, the reason we're having trouble with floods and the shortage of electricity, they're copper. Copper doesn't like water. What's in Portland? Water. We need to put the highest priority on fiber optics within our systems, because if you're having a heart attack or you're having whatever and you don't have that means, that person's in trouble. Number one, it's a public health safety. Number two, we have police, fire, and 911 dispatchers everywhere. We need fiber optics, and we've got to put that higher on the list. And remember, it is jobs. There are highly skilled electricians out there willing to help us with it, and there's people making the fiber optics. So as you talk jobs, please put our communication higher on the list. Anyone wanting any more information, the League has got their open, all the information is available, including a water quality test recently in April. 380 miles of Oregon coast and near shore has been really studied by the League. And guess what the biggest chemical in our Pacific is? And China's not buying our oysters? We hit the nail on the head last April. It's caffeine, because there's no money with DEQ to go out and inspect the septic tanks along the coast. I won't go there.
Marianne,
so
thank
that's
you.
It.
This is great. You know, there's an old saying here in Portland about good citizens being the richest of the city, and I think you and the League of Women Voters are personifying that. Thank you for all the
volunteer time. And you have a stellar one sitting right to your right.
Yes,
and
I do.
It's because of her I joined. A couple of little nitpicky things here.
Okay, I was asked,
Mount Tabor wrote a letter to you guys on the 1st
it.
Of July.
Okay.
We're still waiting confirmation. Thank you, Commissioner Novak and Commissioner Fritz, for responding, telling us to contact you and to contact Commissioner Fish. Well, since July 1, 2013, we're still waiting. Okay. I'm also waiting confirmation on my email to you.
You're waiting for what?
Since the letter was responded to, who's waiting for what?
The people that signed it. It's if you look on the second page.
So we've not only responded to it, Marianne, we've met specifically with Mr. Nyland, the author, and in my office to go over the issue. So
yeah, I think
we've done that.
You covered it. Okay. I was just given this information. That I was given this information 2 days ago. So
yeah,
and I didn't call
him,
your office.
I met with him within 2 months of the assignment, and we had a very robust discussion.
Okay, and I want water back in that tank. Mount Tabor's got to have the water. We've got to protect that investment. I don't care what it costs. I want those security cameras back on. I want those valves corrected. I want those pumps maintained. It's a good backup. It's not broke. Don't damage it by not having water in it. And, Nick, you and I will sit in the raft when we fill it.
Yeah. So
I can't go swimming at WAMO, but you and I'll sit in a raft.
Show up for that.
As we feel it.
I've made this promise. I was approached by Peter. I was approached by Steve Wax. I was approached by Eileen Brady, and I said I will put water in Reservoir 6 if the council concurs, and B, the petitioners do not use it as a new claim in their lawsuit or as the centerpiece of their campaign against the city, because the criticism that we've received by even talking about putting water in is it's a non-mission critical use of ratepayer dollars.
That is horse puckies, well, and I'm part of the Friends of Mount Tabor Reservoir. I'm not taking it, and
you
I'm
and
not
I,
taking
you and
12
on the
inches
same
in
side.
It.
We're on the same side.
I don't
this.
Want mosquitoes
saying,
in that thing.
I don't need another lawsuit. I'm just saying that, you know.
I'll be there.
We think we might make you a special emissary to them to negotiate that. So with that opening line, they're going to fold, I'm sure.
Thank you so much. For letting me go through this this list. And Commissioner Novak, I really, really hope that the people are going to start listening and we get fiber optics out here. And I'm also concerned about the 311 call center to ensure better handling of after normal hours, non-emergency calls, including calls from victims of domestic violence needing assistance. We lost the best attorney in the planet. Yeah. And my heart goes out to his family.
Yeah,
thank you.
All of us do. Thank you, Marianne. You're a treasure. Thank you so much. All right. We'll move to the
My mentor, by the way.
Yes. He's not sure about that either. Thank you, Marianne. Okay. We have a consent calendar. I don't believe we've had any requests to take items off of it.
I'd like to pull 1204.
1204. Okay. Done. Oh, there it is. I'm sorry. It was right here with a red tag on it, and I missed it. Any others? So with the exception of 1204, let's vote on the consent agenda.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye. Mayor, point of order. Mm-hmm. Would the council consent to putting 1204 first on the regular agenda, since I see that Mark Jolin's here, and so that he doesn't have to stick around for 2 hours?
It'd be fine with me, as long as it's okay with the rest of the council.
We have a time certain.
Mark, but
are you here for the Steve Lawson thing? Oh, he's here for Lowenstein.
But he would also be here for 1204.
Let's do Lowenstein and then that.
But yeah, I'm fine. Whatever.
Okay, go ahead and vote, Nick, and we'll finish.
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay, consent calendar is adopted. Now, we do have a series of time certains, but if the item 1204 is not a lengthy one, I think we
No, I'm sorry. I meant first on the regular agenda, Mayor.
After the three time certains?
After the three time certains.
Oh, okay. All right. I don't see any problem with that.
Short. Yeah. I'm just going to say what it is.
Okay. All right. Then let's take item 1189.
Recognize Sandra Goyot as the recipient of the 2013 Steve Lowenstein Trust Award.
Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to invite Art Alexander and Joe Hertzberg and our honoree to come forward. And just tee this up very briefly, Mayor and colleagues. This is the fifth year that I've had the honor of presenting to Council the Steve Lowenstein Trust Award. As we all know, the award is named for attorney, author, and civil rights activist Steve Lowenstein. Steve was the founding director of Oregon Legal Services, a Peace Corps volunteer, an advocate for social justice, and the former chief of staff to Mike Lindbergh. I also learned when I moved to Oregon that Steve's mother was my next-door neighbor in another city. Steve wrote that the recipient of the Trust Award, quote, shall be that person who demonstrated the greatest contribution to assisting the poor and underprivileged in the city of Portland, Oregon. Past recipients have included Mariah Taylor, Casey Jama, Mark Jolin, and Denny West. This year, the board has selected Sandra Goyet, G-O-Y-O-T, pronounced Goyet, for her tireless work with Golden Harvesters, a nonprofit providing meals and serving low-income families in our community. And here to tell us more about Sandra and her service to our community is Art Alexander and Joe Hertzberg. Welcome.
Good morning, Mayor Hales and Council. First, I'd like to extend greetings from our chair, Michelle Harper, who has been the person doing this for several years. Death in the family prevented her from being here this morning, so she wanted to asked me to extend greetings to Council on her behalf. I am very happy to represent the Lowenstein Trust this morning, and I'd like to begin by asking members of the Trust who are here to please stand.
Let's give them a round.
And Chris Wilkinson, and as you mentioned earlier, Mark Jolin, who is a past recipient, is also a member of the Lowenstein Trust. We're very happy to have had him join us. I will go ahead and pass the microphone over to Joe Hertzberg, who will talk a little bit more about Steve's legacy.
Well, let me just say a few things about Steve, because I think most of you didn't know him, although, as Nick points out, I first met him because we were introduced by Steve's mother, who you can probably find in Wikipedia if you look up Feisty or Firecracker. Steve's resume is pretty amazing. He worked in the early days of the War on Poverty, worked for the Ford Foundation in Ethiopia and Chile. He founded Oregon Legal Services and the Oregon Law Foundation, and he wrote the definitive book about the history of the Jews of Oregon. He also found somewhere in that 52-year, too short lifetime, 6 years to work in this building as Mike Lindbergh's chief of staff. Mike is also a member of the Loans Trust Board. Those were in the 80s when Bud Clark and Frank Ivancy were mayor, when the council had members like Margaret Strawn, Dick Bogle, Earl Blumenauer. And Steve was trusted and respected as a straight shooter, consensus builder, and a passionate advocate for the disadvantaged. I think the most important part of Steve's legacy right now is that every one of you has people in your bureaus who consider Steve to be a mentor and a role model. There are people all around this city who ask regularly, what would Steve do? And the answer usually is, let's go get dessert. He had a hopeless sweet tooth, far worse than yours, Steve. He drove an embarrassing lemon of a car that he wouldn't get rid of for 15 years. He had a infectious cackle of a laugh that would fill a room. But those aren't the things that bring us here. The things that bring us here are Steve's passionate commitment to this city and to the disadvantaged of this city. As members of the Trust Board, we have to ask, what would Steve do every year? And it's a privilege and a serious responsibility.
And in this year's recognition, we are very happy to, in this year's award, we're very happy to recognize Sandra Goyette, and for her tremendous work with Golden Harvesters. They provide meals, food, clothing for people who are deeply in need. I had the opportunity to visit their location, and it was bustling. And that was one of the coldest days we've had recently. It was packed, and the volunteers who work there are doing tremendous work, and we are recognizing Sandra for her decade of commitment to increasing the capacity of Golden Harvesters. They started off in a very small space, and due to her efforts, they've managed to move through two other spaces to a space now that's large enough to provide a good measure of service. Still needs some measure of work, but Sandra's going to talk about it. And I will go ahead and turn the microphone over to our awardee for 2013. Sandra.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank the Lowenstein Trust Foundation for this award, and I also want to thank the City Council for this time to be with you, and our members. With me came Jesse Baker, and he is a general contractor who did most of the work on the remodel of our new building that we have just moved into. It was a six-month. He happened not to have to be working. For 6 months, he worked diligently every week and every day till he got it done with the help of our volunteers. If you don't know what Golden Harvesters is, Golden Harvesters is a food pantry run by all volunteers, and we have active members. Our active members are a total of about 140 people, which include over 500 when you put their families together. And then besides helping them, then if we have any extra We never let anything go to waste. We have other agencies that we go to, and we call, we take things to them. We have several agencies, so nothing will go to waste in our program. As I said, we are all volunteers. I've been a volunteer for Golden Harvesters, which is located in St. John's, for between 9 and going on my 10th year. And how I got started in this, after being recovering from a long illness, I started to volunteer because it was like I couldn't work anymore, but there was something I needed to do. And I got involved much more than I thought I'd ever would be. I'm currently the treasurer, and I write all the grants. This experience has been extremely rewarding for me and at times tremendously frustrating. The rewards are many, from the simple thank yous that you get from the small little boy that you gave a toy to, or a peach or an apple to his parents that maybe don't have any food for the day, and we will give food. If they come to our door, we will give them food if they don't have money. We get our money. The only way we are ran is by the $20 a month that our families pay to come in and get groceries. And it's a slim picking. And I have to take all that money, and we have to pay our bills. And so I always have a long list of things that need to be done. We will be starting our 26th year in the first of the year, and I'm looking forward to this coming year, which is big space that is still kind of in a work in progress. We have no more money, but we continue on. And it's extremely rewarding at times. And one of the most frustrating things I found is when we had outgrown our building and we couldn't find a building that we could afford to live in or rent. Finally, after 2.5 years of looking, we found this wonderful, wonderful man who let us have this building that had been empty for 10 years. And he said, just go in and do whatever. And so he is so gracious, and we are so thankful for it. The thing about Golden Harvesters is I have a want list and a need list, and that need list is long. And with the funds that we're going to receive from Golden Harvest for the Lovestein Foundation, I can get some of those things off that list. One of the first things I know that I will buy, I know in my heart that's what I'll buy, excuse me, is I have $1,000 from a grant that I got, but a new freezer will cost $1,700, and I have to use some money by the end of the month. So now I can buy that freezer and have it delivered within the next week or so that we really desperately need. And little things like that might seem unimportant to people, but to us it is. And yesterday, something really, I went over to Golden Harvesters because I had some things to do. We're only open Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And somebody knocked on the door, and I opened the door, and this man handed me an envelope. And I said, thank you. And then about a half an hour later, knock on the door. Another person handed me an envelope. I said, thank you, and I put it down. And then about a half an hour later, another person knocked on the door and said, can I come in? I want to help you. And so he came in. So we were awarded with money in checks just yesterday that we didn't even ever expect to get. And now with this and this money here, I have so many things that we need. It's going to be I'm so thankful that God is always looking at and helping us out. Excuse me. I am very emotional about Golden Harvesters. It has become just part of me. And I really appreciate this award. I really, really do. And thank you.
Sorry. Thank you.
Sandra, if other people are moved by what you just said and want to contribute, how can they do that? Where should they go?
Oh, well, if people want to contribute, they can mail us. They can mail, and our address is 8100 North Lombard. We have somebody making a new Facebook page, but if you look in it, it's got one of them's got the old address, and we can't get in to change it. And they can stop by. We're open 9 to 1, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And come in and see if anybody, we operate only on volunteers. If anybody wants to come and volunteer, you're always welcome. We always need volunteers.
So officially, on behalf of the board of the Lowenstein Trust, I'm very proud to present the 2013 Lowenstein Trust Award to Sandra Gale.
Thank you.
As well as a check for the support of Golden Hearts.
Here, they wanted to get a photograph.
Let's take a photo.
And we'd like you to come in front to take a photo.
We'd love to take a photo with you, Sandra. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.